This is Wealth Wake Up on KGMI with Dick Donahue.
The opinions voiced in Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial, or tax advisor prior to investing. Securities offered through Cetera Advisor Networks, member FINRA, SIPC. Investment advice offered through CWM, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Cetera Advisor Networks is under separate ownership from any other named entity. Guests of Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue are not affiliated with Cetera Advisor Networks, CWM, LLC, or Asset Advisors, LLC.
Welcome to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you Sunday morning here on KGMI. Well, the market's hitting new highs. We still think it's a buy. The Dow Jones and S&P 500 are breathing down the neck of record highs set last fall. Some take that as a sign to sell, time to shift out of equities and realize gains. We think that that would be a mistake. At the end of last year, we forecast the Dow would finish this year at 28,750, while the S&P would hit about 3,100. At the time, these goals seemed outlandishly optimistic to many investors. Well, grit your teeth if you have to. Those who stay invested in the year ahead should earn substantial rewards. Now we think maybe we were a little bit too pessimistic. We think investors should be undeterred by new record highs. To assess market valuations, we use a capitalized profits model, which takes the government measure of profits from the GDP reports and divides it by interest rates. Think of it this way. If profits are higher, stocks should be higher too. If interest rates are higher, stocks should be lower. As they compete against each other, alternative with a higher rate of return. Our traditional measure, using a current 10-year Treasury yield of about 2.57%, suggests that the S&P 500 is still massively undervalued. At the end of last year, we used 3.4% for the 10-year yield, generated a fair value of the S&P of 3,100. Now that looks like it was an aggressive call for long-term yields. Using, say, 3% for the 10-year value puts the fair market value at 3,500. The model needs a 10-year yield of nearly 3.6% to conclude that the S&P 500 is already fair value with recent profits. That would obviously throw the cap profits model for a loop, would be a recession, but we don't see one on the horizon. As we said last week, the U.S. economy is on very solid ground, with first quarter real GDP estimates up from near zero to now over 2%. In addition, we lack the imbalances we often see before recessions. Household debts are near a multiple-decade low relative to assets, and household debt services very low relative to after-tax income. Banks, meanwhile, have ample capital and are no longer tied to the overly strict mark-to-market accounting rules that exacerbated the financial crisis. In addition, the economy is still adapting to lower tax rates, particularly in corporate profits. We expect a continued shift of corporate operations towards the U.S. Another angle to consider is that recessions often follow drops in home building, but the U.S. is still building fewer homes than we'd expect given population growth and scrappage of homes, which includes knockdowns, fires, floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, etc. In other words, we think the number of housing starts, which have grown every calendar year since bottoming in 2009, will rise again in 2019. Notice, however, that what we're not worried about, quantitative tightening, which is one of President Trump's favorite recent targets. We still don't think quantitative easing helped equities because the extra reserves in the banking system sat on balance sheets earning near zero returns. Withdrawing those previously inert reserves won't hurt markets either. To be sure, we're not saying stocks will go up today or this week or even this quarter. Corrections happen. But given the level of corporate profits and our outlook for the economic growth, it looks more likely than not that equities will move substantially higher in the year ahead. Okay, looking at this weekly summary that came in, we're seeing that U.S. consumer spending is bouncing back. For the week ending the 18th of April, U.S. retail sales rebounded in March. China's economy grew faster than expected. U.S. industrial production weakened. And the United Kingdom labor market remained strong amid Brexit uncertainty. So global equities increased slightly. The U.S. 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.56% from 2.5% a week ago, while the price of West Texas Intermediate crude declined slightly to $63.60 a barrel. Volatility is measured by the Chicago Board of Options Exchange Volatility Index, or VIX as we know it, declined to 12.62 from last Friday's 13.21. Okay, so U.S. retail sales strengthened in March. Following months of weakness, retail sales expanded 1.6% in March from the prior month, beating economists' expectations of 1%, and posted the largest increase since September of 17. Auto sales, gas prices recorded strong gains, surging 3.1% and 3.5% respectively. If you exclude autos and gas, retail sales still increased by a solid 0.9%, higher than the expected 0.7%. The bounce back in consumer spending suggests that the U.S. economic growth in the first quarter was likely stronger than many had predicted. And China recorded a 6.4% economic growth rate in the first quarter, surpassing the expectations of many economists. Growth was supported by strong industrial production, which surged 8.5%, and consumer spending, which grew by 8.7%. In recent months, the government issued new measures, such as tax cuts, infrastructure spending, and looser monetary policy to help stabilize business activity and stimulate the economy. In addition, the recent ease in trade tensions between the United States and China helped lift business confidence. Nonetheless, China's growth still is the slowest in decades, and economists and the government expect the economy to continue to slow. Currently, the government's target rate is at 6 to 6.5% for 2019. And U.S. industrial production slowed in March amid a global slowdown. U.S. industrial production, which is a measure of output at factories, mining companies, and utilities, declined 0.1% month over month in March, below expectations of a 0.2% gain. And it slipped 0.3% for the first quarter. Mining output was the biggest drag on industrial production, falling 0.8% for the month. In addition, manufacturing production remained weak, coming in flat for the month, following declines in both January and February, edging down 1.1% at an annual rate of first quarter. It was the first drop since the third quarter of 2017. The weaker data suggests that the global economic slowdown is putting downward pressure on the U.S. manufacturing sector. And the United Kingdom employment rate is at a 44-year low. The UK employment rate fell to 3.9% for the three-month period ending January, the lowest level since 1975, and down from 4% in the prior month. The economy added 222,000 jobs to the workforce, and average hourly earnings grew by 3.4%. The labor market has held up better than expected despite mounting fears over Brexit, suggesting that the political turmoil over Brexit has yet to significantly impact the market. However, some are concerned that businesses are opting to increase hiring to meet demand rather than increasing in production, boosting technology due to the prolonged uncertainty. As a result, the decline in business investment may lead to weaker growth in the future. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be back shortly.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here on KGMI. We're Asset Advisors located out in the Pacific Commerce Center. That's the complex out on the Pacific Highway heading to Ferndale, out next to Wilson's Furniture. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101, Ferndale, 98248. Our phone number, 360-733-1200. Give us a call. Check out our website at assetadvisorsllc.net or wealthwakeup.com. Okay, I want to also make an announcement here. I talked about this a little bit reality yesterday on Saturday's live show, but Common Threads Northwest and the Fourth Corner are sponsoring a forum out at Meridian High School this Thursday. That's April 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. That's in the Meridian High School auditorium. And it's titled is, It's About Taxes, Ain't It? Can We Afford to Live in Whatcom County? The speakers will include Keith Wilnauer, Whatcom County Treasurer, Assessor, Ron Wieson, Skagit County Commissioner, and also Olympia Watchdogs, Glenn Morgan and David Bowes. Glenn is Executive Director of CAPER and also the founder of We the Governed. David Bowes is Communications Director for the Washington Policy Center. And they'll focus on what's happening in Olympia, including property tax increases, estate income tax, carbon taxes. Notice and think about that. Every word that we're talking about includes taxes. A whole bunch of tax proposals. So anyway, that's Thursday night, April 25th from 7 to 9 p.m. You can find more information on the forum at info@commonthreadsnorthwest.org. Look forward to seeing you there. Okay, continuing with this week's economic news. The U.S. trade deficit shrank in February. Narrowed 3.4% to $49.4 billion, the lowest level since June of 2018, and below what economists expected. Exports grew by 1.1%, while imports rose by only 0.2% from the prior month. In addition, the deficit in goods with China fell 9.3% as the U.S. exported more to China than was imported. In recent months, trade tensions between the U.S. and China have eased as they appear to be moving closer to a deal. Both companies have scheduled two rounds of meetings over the next few months with an aim of securing a deal in late May or early June, though this still remains tentative. And U.S. healthcare stocks have underperformed amid political pressures after being considered a market leader just last summer. U.S. healthcare stocks are significantly underperforming this year, sparked by signs that both political parties are in support for tighter regulations in healthcare space ahead of the 2020 presidential election. And while Democrats are vying for a single-payer system, the Trump administration is looking to regulate drug prices. As a result of the policy proposals from both sides, the S&P 500 healthcare sector rose only 0.5% year-to-date as of Wednesday, significantly trailing the broader indexes. Despite the recent underperformance, healthcare remains strong on the earnings front, with a consensus earnings per share growth of 5.1%, which is the highest among all S&P 500 sectors. In the area of the healthcare market, there have been less political risks. Medical devices, for example, are an area that has limited pressures and regulation from the government. Medical Devices Group has high barriers to entry and low risk of patent expiration, so technological development from within healthcare equipment and services should pave the way for companies to win that offer or value proposition that meets a large need of society. And in earning news overall, roughly 15% of the constituents of the S&P 500 have indexed have reported the first quarter earnings. They're expected to decline approximately 3.8% year over year, according to FactSet Research. Meanwhile, revenues are expected to expand at a 5.2% rate. Okay, more detail on the March retail sales report. The booming retail sales report confirms there's no recession in sight and that the consumer remains on very solid footing. Retail sales soared 1.6% in March, beating even the most optimistic forecast by any economics group and rising by the most since September of 17. The gains in March were broad-based, with 12 of 13 major categories showing rising sales. The largest gain in dollar terms was for autos, but even outside of autos, retail sales rose 1.2%. Core sales, which exclude autos, building materials, and gas stations, which are the most volatile sectors, were up 1% in March and were up 3.7% from a year ago, while overall retail sales are up 3.6% over the same period. So you're plugging this data shows that the real GDP grew at close to 2.5% annual rate in the first quarter. Meanwhile, the severity of the December decline in sales will remain a complete mystery, given how inconsistent the report was with other economic data. December's 4.5% decline in sales at non-store retailers, which includes internet sales, was the largest percentage drop since November of 2008. Give us a break. Something is wrong with the December report. Seasonals, missing data, or an error in the spreadsheets. Unsurprisingly, it only took non-store sales 2 months to completely wipe out this strange December decline. Non-store sales rose 1.2% in March, or up 11.6% from a year ago, and sit at all-time highs. In fact, for the first time ever, in February, non-store retailers surpassed general merchandise stores. This trend continued in March, and we don't expect it to change. Some stores will continue to close, but it's not due to a weak consumer, just a shift in preferences. Given the tailwinds from deregulation and tax cuts, we expect an average real GDP growth rate of close to 3% in 2019, just like we saw in 2018. Jobs and wages are now moving up, tax cuts have taken effect, consumer balance sheets look healthy, and serious 90-plus day debt delinquencies are down substantially from post-recession highs. Some may point to household debt at a record high as a reason to doubt the consumption growth can continue, but household assets are near a record high as well. Relative assets, household debt levels are hovering near the lowest in more than 30 years. For these reasons, expect solid gains in retail sales over the coming months. And February's International Trade Report also came out, and the deficit shrunk unexpectedly in February to $49.4 billion. More important, there was a rebound in the total volume of trade, imports plus exports, which signals how much businesses and consumers interact across the U.S. border. Exports rose by $2.3 billion, while imports grew by $0.6 billion. Total trade is still off the record high set in October of 2018, but expected to hit new highs later this year as global growth starts to reaccelerate and trade deals continue to progress. In the last year, exports were up 2.4%, while imports are actually down 0.5%. In the meantime, one positive implication of the report is that the net exports look like they make a large positive contribution to real GDP in the first quarter. As a result, we're estimating that real GDP grew in the 2 to 2.5% range in the quarter, much better than many analysts have been recently forecasting. So despite lamentations by the pounding pundits, the China trade battles appear largely behind us, and the worst-case scenarios much discussed on the financial news over the past year have once again proven excessively pessimistic. We never believed an all-out trade war would materialize, but that short-term skirmishes would lead to longer-term deals for all countries involved. We have already seen it happen with several countries, and now China looks to be extending an olive branch too. Average tariffs in China were cut by 9.8% in 2017 to 7.5% in 2018. We see this as real progress and just the start. The U.S.'s renegotiating position is strong, in no small part due to the rise in the U.S. as an energy powerhouse. As recently as 2005, the U.S. was importing more than 10 times the petroleum products that they were exporting. As of February, petroleum imports are down to 1.09 times exports, and this trend should continue. This massive shift means the U.S. has changed power of dynamics on a global scale. Witness the political turmoil in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Middle East. We'll continue to watch trade policy as it develops, but we don't see any reason to sound the alarm bells. Okay, I'm going to throw a quick story in here right real quick. We have a fun story. The toddler locked his dad out of his iPad for 48 years. A father in the D.C. area posted a picture on his iPad that went viral. The picture shows that the iPad is disabled for 25 million minutes, or about 48 years. Apparently, his 3-year-old child unsuccessfully tried to log in 1 or 20 too many times. The good news is that time flies fast, so in 2067, he should be here in no time, and he'll have access to his iPad again. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be back shortly. And I'm proud to be an American. Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here on KGMI. Okay, going to have our industrial production capacity utilization report for March. And it disappointing March, falling short of expectations and posting its second decline in 3 months. The March weakness also pulled the first quarter into negative territory, representing the first such quarterly decline since late 2017. That said, there is no need to sound alarm bells on the industrial sector or shoehorn in the narrative of slowing global growth, as many analysts are doing. The primary source of weakness over the last 3 months has come from the typically volatile auto sector, which fell 6.7% in January and 2.5% in March. Meanwhile, industrial production, excluding autos, was unchanged in March and rose a modest 0.1% in the first quarter. The bright spot in the report was that manufacturing production outside the auto sector, which represents the majority of activity, rebounded by 0.2% after 2 months of weakening readings. In the past year, auto production is down 4.5%, while manufacturing outside the auto sector is up 1.5%, demonstrating the ongoing divergence in activity between the two sectors. Further, the various capital goods indices within the manufacturing continue to show healthy growth at a pace above headline industrial production, with business equipment up 3.7%, machinery up 4.3%, and high-tech equipment up 3.5%. Comparing this with a slower year-over-year growth of 1%, the manufacturing as a whole is up 0.2% for non-durable goods, shows that companies are continuing to invest. In turn, more capital goods should help push productivity growth higher, making it easier for the economy to grow in spite of a tight labor market. The other source of weakness in the report came from mining, which fell 0.8% due to a slowdown in oil and gas extraction. That said, overall index remains near a record high and represents the fastest year-over-year growth of any major category at 10.5%. The report shows once again why it's important to analyze the details of economic reports rather than cause for concern, as a brief glimpse at the headline reading might suggest. Industrial production continues to show an economy on very solid ground. And in other news, the entire Empire State Index, which measures factory sentiment in New York region, rose to 10.1 in April from 3.7 in March. This signals a rebound in the optimism for the index, touched its lowest reading since mid-2017 in March. And initial claims for unemployment fell 5,000 last week to 192,000, the lowest level since 1969. Continuing claims, meanwhile, fell 63,000 to 1.653 million. Both of these figures suggest another month of solid growth in April. In turn, we expect continued reduction in investors' assessment of the odds of a Fed rate cut later this year. On the manufacturing front, the Philly Fed Index, which is a measure of East Coast factory sentiment, declined to a still solid plus 8.5 in April, signaling continued growth. Okay, more detail here. Okay, U.S. Attorney General William Barr released the much anticipated redacted version of the special counsel Robert Mueller's report. As Barr noted in summary at the end of March, the report finds no evidence of collusion between the Russians and the president or any American to affect the 2016 presidential race, and Barr found no evidence in the report that the president obstructed justice by hindering the investigation, though Mueller did leave the question of obstruction open to congressional interpretation. What does it mean? Well, this report will be a political fodder for the next 20 months, but it didn't move the needle in equity markets, which is a good thing. It shows that investors correctly anticipated what would come of releasing the report. Not much. And industrial production is off 0.1%, led lower by manufacturing. Industrial production slipped 0.1%, missing expectations, 0.3% growth. What does it mean? Well, manufacturing fell 0.3% in March after dropping 0.4% in February. It's not good, but consumer goods were also down for the month by 0.2%. But it's not all bad news. Business equipment rebounded 0.4% after falling 0.8% in February. Capacity utilization ticked up 0.6% to 78.8. Before 2008, capacity utilization averaged over 80% during economic expansions. During this era of muddled growth, we haven't been able to get above that key level. But overall, numbers show that the U.S. economy remains steady, albeit at a very slow level of expansion. We might be the envy of the development world, which comes to growth, but it's not a very high bar. And we talked about retail sales were up 1.6%, well above the 0.8% estimate. Vehicle sales were up 3.3%, drove the numbers higher. Excluding autos and gas, sales increased 0.9%. What does it mean? Well, the strength runs across sectors, including non-store retailers, restaurants. The only group left out are department stores, which surprises no one. The month's retail sales show that consumers bounced back in the last month of the first quarter, which should give GDP growth a bit of a boost. The Atlanta Fed's GDP Now forecasting model shows the first quarter GDP growing at 2.8%. That's over 2% higher than their forecast just a month ago. And the first quarter GDP prints above 2%, it will give the equity markets a tailwind that could push the indices up several points higher. U.S. retailers announced more store closings so far in 2019 and then all of 2018. Led by Payless, retailers have announced 5,994 store closings this year, compared with 5,864 in all of 2018. What does this mean? We'll call it the changing face of retail. We know that consumers are spending, but it's a matter of where they go, what they do with the part, and how what they do with their cash or credit. E-commerce continues to grow. The Dollar General is adding several hundred locations this year, but the scales tilt to fewer retail locations with stores like Payless, Gymboree, JCPenney, and Signet Jewelers shrinking their footprints. The moves will cut out some retail employment opportunities and hurt shopping malls. Housing starts were essentially flat in March following down months. The numbers were the weakest since May of 2017. They're off 14.2% year over year. What does this mean? Well, new homes represent just 10% of the annual residential real estate market, but they're a good barometer of how the industry professionals view the current situation. Clearly, home builders are pessimistic about real estate. Not only are housing starts falling, but also permits are dropping. New home permits fell 1.7%, and they're now down 7.8% lower than this time last year. Housing starts are particularly volatile and subject to weather, so it's possible the numbers will bounce back in April. Possible, but not likely. We'll see. And the Chinese first quarter GDP expanded at 6.4%. The growth rate slightly beat expectations and puts the country on a pace to grow at the slowest rate since 2009. What does this mean? Well, who would have thought the Chinese economy would grow by the exact amount that the Chinese government had forecast? What are the odds? Given that the government controls all aspects of the country's economy, including statistical compilations, their releases, the chances are pretty good that China would meet its forecast. But there are other indications that things aren't so rosy. The central government is encouraging local governments to provide more financing for economic projects, which is odd because the central government has spent several years trying to reduce public debt levels. The about-face makes it look like officials are worried about a general slowdown. But the solution might just aggravate the problem. Adding more local debt today for capital projects such as infrastructure and power generation would only create more headaches down the road for local governments that are strapped for operating cash. Local governments generate much of the income by selling land for development, a transactional business with a finite lifespan. Eventually, the development boom will end and the debt will come due. The only question is whether or not the central government will step in and save the investors who purchased the local debt. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be back shortly.
'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you here on KGMI this Sunday morning and in this Easter Sunday. So I want to wish everybody a happy Easter this weekend. Okay, the Bank of Japan is expected to report weak inflation. In spite of printing trillions of yen, the Bank of Japan is about to report that the country will fall short of its 2% inflation goal, and that inflation will remain weak for the next 3 years. What does this mean? Well, the Bank of Japan might not be able to manufacture inflation, but they definitely get an A for effort. The central bank has printed and spent so much yen that it now owns 43% of all Japanese government bonds outstanding, an amount that surpasses annual GDP. When the Bank of Japan ran out of bonds to buy, it started to pick up stocks. It's now the top 10 stockholder in 49.7% of all companies in the first section of the Tokyo Stock Exchange. And Stockton, California rolls out universal basic income program. The struggling California town, known for going bankrupt, began sending $500 a month to 130 recipients. The official hope is that the funds will provide the lives of the recipients through better health care choices, less anxiety, and more time with family, or even giving them the opportunity to pursue new businesses. 25 of them will report how it affects their lives during the three-year program. The recipients don't have to qualify or maintain any status, such as drug-free. It's unclear what Stockton will do with the results. The program is being underwritten by grants. Beyond establishing that free money from a grant with no strings attached is attractive, there aren't many metrics on which to judge the program. Notably, Finland recently ended its large universal basic income pilot program early because the results were disappointing. While recipients enjoyed the extra cash, it made them no more likely to take lower-paying jobs or pursue business interests than the control group, and it was expensive. This next week, the last week of April, brings reports on new home sales, existing home sales, durable goods orders, and the first estimate of the U.S. first quarter GDP. Well, we have a little bit of a eulogy for a fallen spire. And it's not what we can say to mark a tragedy like the burning of the Notre Dame. It's about what we can't. Our society communicates in sound bites. For every news flash, every major event, give us 2 minutes, we'll have a compressed our reactions into 280 characters, ready to share with the world. But on Monday, when the Notre Dame de Paris burned, our responses sounded flat and shallow. They sounded flat because we no longer know how to relate to the past. We live in a culture that idealizes progress. This progressive mindset tells us that we are constantly improving, that we live far better than our forebears did. Our technology is so much more advanced, our understanding of science and the world around us more nuanced. We cycle through popular philosophies and ideas and political theories, consistently optimizing, discarding the ideas of yesterday for the hypothesis of today. Because, as we all know, today marks the pinnacle of human history, at least until next week. What we don't realize is how tightly our obsession with progress is woven into the fabric of our lives. Why, after all, would we want to keep anything permanent when we are constantly improving anyway? To hang on to the past is to miss out on a better tomorrow. We generate content and merchandise that will disappear as quickly as we make it, and we will supplant something shinier, more compelling, and more functional. At home, we surround ourselves with things like we know will be replaced with the new and improved versions in a couple of years. We drift from city to city, following new careers and opportunities, never growing too attached to any apartment or house, swapping our friends like sets of keys, forgetting names and addresses with every move. Throughout the stream of progress and change are monuments like the Notre Dame, a resounding contradiction to the claim that today will always be better than yesterday. World wonders like the cathedral, relics of the past, stand above and beyond the constant tweaks and improvements and ebbs and flows of the modern age. Somehow, despite their age and their outdated architecture, they endure. And even after so many centuries, Notre Dame continues to inspire us in ways we can't quite put into words. and a strange inconsistency in our worldview. Even as we believe we ride the cresting wave of human history, we assume we'll never create anything as great or as enduring as the geniuses of the past. It wouldn't even occur to us to try. And yet on Monday, we found ourselves face to face with an event that forced the chisel and the carving tools into our own hands. The fire that consumed Notre Dame demanded that we say something that would reflect the scope and weight of 850 years of history, something that would describe the loss of a spire in flames. We were called upon to acknowledge that this seemingly unchanging bulwark of time, of art, of history, at the end of the day is just like us. It, too, is beholden to the passage of time. It, too, is transient. But unlike everything else in our lives, we know it follows different rules. We know we can't really replace it. And we certainly know we can't improve it. We have no idea where to start. Far be it from us to engage with the enduring. Our ever-changing society doesn't give us the tools or mental framework to comprehend what Notre Dame means or just what we lost. It is the moment we come face-to-face with a complete failure in our culture's worldview. Since we have no vocabulary for the past, we have to fall back on the vocabulary we do have and understand the language of a tragic news story or of a personal disappointment, something that feels terrible for the moment but will get fixed in a little while or will be forgotten after a couple more news flashes and distractions. Yet the whole time we try to talk about what happened, every time we shake our heads and murmur, terrible or so sad, in the back of our minds we have a vague, uncomfortable sense that it's not what we meant at all, that we are missing what really happened here. But what else is there to say? When the weight of the past is thrust upon our shoulders, what are we supposed to do? This is Notre Dame's challenge to the progressive man. Notre Dame doesn't just contradict our culture by standing against the march in progress. It connects the past, present, and the future by expressing truths that never change. The cathedral endures as an icon of humanity because it reaches into the past, building on the Greco-Roman tradition and involving the depths of the Christian faith, telling us of the grandeur of heaven and the beauty of an eternal God reaching down to show mercy in a sinful world. Even if we don't know the names of the craftsmen, we hear what they're telling us, though almost 1,000 years of stonework and time. The fire in Notre Dame reminds us that monuments of the past can and will pass one day. But the inverse is true as well. The transience of Notre Dame also will remind us of the transience of the craftsmen who built it. Like us, they spoke words nobody will remember, and like us, they make things that were long been lost in time. The craftsmen of the cathedral had several limits we do today, but the only thing that distinguishes them from us is how they drew up the wisdom of the past to express truths that never change, and how they sought to tell those stories in a way that would last generations to come. That is how they created a monument that endures, and how the power of Notre Dame's message echoes through a future that its creators could never have imagined. Temporary men told a story in stone, wood, and glass that still speaks to us. It's up to us not to just listen to the message, but to learn how to build upon it and how to reflect in our own lives the truths that Notre Dame proclaims. It's our job how to maintain a connection to the past and to do our part to extend the connection and beyond tomorrow. To learn the lessons of the artists, writers, and philosophers of the past can teach us, and do our part to better understand and testify to the truths that tell. Fire, war, and time may destroy the wonders of the past, but they can't destroy the truths those wonders express, not as long as you are there to continue the tradition that came before you. When your heritage calls on you, as it did on Monday, you can draw your response from that well. That is where we'll all find what to say. Dick Donahue, there's one more quickie. Don't forget Thursday night out here at Meridian High School, 7 to 9 p.m. Going to have a forum out there sponsored by Common Threads Northwest, the fourth corner. Can we afford to live in Whatcom County? It's about taxes. Pretty good forum scheduled. Come join us, 7 to 9 p.m., Meridian High School. Thanks for listening. Happy Easter. Don't forget our live show on Saturdays at 11 o'clock. Give us a call if you got questions, 360-733-1200. Have a good week.